Michael Heller is a poet, essayist, and critic. He is often associated with objectivist poets such as Karl Rakosi and George Oppen, whose work he has explicated and continues to emulate. His book of essays, Convictions, Net of Branches, now holds a classic status in the history of American objectivism. But such labeling sells his poetic genius short and misses his perceptive and magical charm. His first published poems were composed after a short visit to Nerja on the coast of Spain in 1966, an area that I know well. Michael and I share many common reference points, both as persons and poets. We have had conversations in multiple venues over the last 30 years or so, poetry readings in and around New York City, and importantly, up in Orono, Maine, where years ago we shared some fascinating conversation with Armin Schwerner, author of The Tablets, a foundational text of contemporary Gnostic poetry. We have crossed paths so often because of the influences we share and the commitments that underlie our writing. I especially remember a brief essay of Michael's where a sympathy for Louis Zukofsky's moral ethos is the dominant theme. You may know that when I edited the Orr's anthologies, that beautiful conundrum that weds ethics and the measures in which poetics delight was foremost among the concepts that intrigued me. This has been true also of Michael in his highly distinguished career, now culminating with This Constellation is a Name, Collected Poems 1965 to 2010 from Nightbook. In the Zukofsky essay, Michael warns us to be cautious about the aleatory freewheeling that seems all too common in today's poetry. At the same time, Michael's poetry is not by any means a constructed thing in the formalist sense described by some language-centered poets or the new conceptual poets. Instead, his work is open to processes of perception, following upon perception, and is rooted in contemporary realities. Perhaps the possibility of form as immanent within true perception identifies the faith to which Michael and I both adhere. What you must do, if you are so inclined, is to listen to the world that impinges upon the senses, sometimes abruptly. In an early volume in The Builded Place, he wrote, "The language falls like a chunk of disembodied sound through space." Later, from what I read over and over again, his eschaton, one heard the sound in any case, muffled piano chords, which set up a slight saw-edged vibration as though beneath the skin. There is a hint of violence, a startle effect in both of these responses to the phenomenal world. At the edge of perception, the identity of objects and their forms is at stake. Quote, "And suddenly an identity was losing base, as if a yearning not to be form barely shimmered through those veiled processions of chords." Michael's poems are obsessive about the form of words and have titles like At Word Brink. For me, one of the most brilliant poems in eschaton is The Chronicle Poet. A chronicle, as you may remember, is a registration of events, very linear in form, hewing to the order of perception. In this poem, he writes, "One tries pulling syllables clean, like freeing old nails from plaster." A search for language that is freeing but rooted or embedded in a friable substance like plaster, as those nails are, together with an attentive and caring response to ordinary reality. For me, that is Michael's practice at its best, and I think it is also true of Michael's sense of himself, even from the first unwinding of words and syllables in his infancy. Michael.
Don, thank you so much for that. That was just lovely, and I have no disagreements with that. And thank you all for coming. I thought I'd invoke the spirits just by reading a poem of Vincent Farini's first and one of Olson's, just to set the atmosphere. I don't know Vincent Farini's work very well, but I started looking through it and just loved it. This poem, Ritual Inclusion. The talking is dying to rest in the Venus of the questing cargo. The statements hopscotch on the roller coaster of the Old Testament. The bakuk of blood has a reflection zigzagging in lost eyes. The rabbi of the third coming is at supper with the Messiah. No one believes you hitching a ride on your satellite. But the ox cart is your home, and so is the breadbasket of the Psalms. The seven branches of wisdom get their blue flame with 3 and 9. It was Vincent. May you rest where poets rest well. And a poem by Olson, which I've always loved, La Chute, La Fall. My drum hollowed out through the thin slit carved from the cedar wood, the base I took when the tree was felled. Oh, my lute wrought from the tree's crown, my drum whose lustiness was not to be resisted, my lute from whose pulsations no one could turn away. They are where the dead are. My drum fell where the dead are. Who will bring it up, my lute? Who will bring it up where it fell in the face of them, where they are, where my lute and drum have fallen? I'm going to read some new poems first, and then I'll read from the book. I tell people this is a not a tomb, but a tome, so I have to keep going, you know. I'll just read a few more things. There are those for whom figures on balconies exist, if only as possibilities. People in photographs with arms outstretched in salute or worship before the empty terrace where a figure is meant to appear for now, for repeated scenes, for always. And there are those with their politics, their fears and hopes, caught in those adoring thrusts, who must make their gestures even as they are the ones whose gestures will be mocked, even as that mocking is accounted for. There exists the brushed back reticence of the eye that makes one otherworldly to the world. Un outre, as in Rimbaud's case, enslaved, the poet wrote by his baptismal rite. So it is with ritual, with repeats of word or act. The forms insist on want, on warmth, desired as at a drafty window. Is all clear, clear as that sun-filled winter day, lucent, brutal, and severe. With so much glare, the scene seems pathless, static in its brilliance. Internet enabled. Turns out, Tirso de Molina, 16th century Spanish monk, born of conversos, dreamed up top trickster Don Juan. 150 years later, Emmanuel Conigliano, converted Jew, a.k.a. Lorenzo da Ponte, penned the libretto for Don Giovanni. Online journal Tablet Magazine claims these origins, despite the Catholic faith of all characters and composer as well, make this, perhaps Mozart's greatest work, a Jewish opera. Turns out, according to the internet, Don Giovanni's ethos runs an electronic river through paranoid URL after URL. No one truly good can do much to save anyone from evil, not even a loving Christ, whose open arms and forgiveness are as naught to a sociopath like Don Giovanni. So, best to kill, and if needed, get what you need to get, according to the internet, with its hate sites, ad for AK-47s, designs for IEDs, for gas attacks. But let's surf back to Mozart. His opera, beautiful, so lovely, in fact, Yiddish poet Glatstein writes, "Instead of God, we should revere Mozart, whose music surpasses in holiness the Sermon on the Mount." I agree. Despite my irreligion, I have a deep love for Don Giovanni's divine last chorus, the one directors often cut, in which singers sing of justice triumphant over evil after the villain has been led to the pit. If the Abrahamic God exists, he's hidden, never graven, his voice profound in the commendatory's implacable, graveled, "Mi invitasti." Little found poem. In the hallway. Sign on classroom door. Quote, "The mystical experience in literature has been canceled." Notes on notes. Had hoped for Buddhas, the wrathful deities beringed in flames and adorned with the skulls of others, their clawed feet standing on the ego's neck, on the root of the soul, the heart, and the human. They are real, one told oneself. They will slit the throat of those who pretend to own their selfhood or their perceptions. They always take the side of the cosmos. So why the bleak view? Don't you live among the ordinary, between the ability to exist and the premonition that one doesn't, between the red brick and the zip code, between there-ness and location? Maybe to rely on science, TV ads or bad movies talked away, no more than the sky's rain of microparticles that pass painlessly through one. The guns, the war crimes, the, yes, terror and dread are a portion, but his prayers for the day and the homily are a portion. Whose turn to gather up Antigone as she gathered her brother's remains? Whose turn to be Phocion's wife in Poussin's painting, bringing home her husband's ashes? Some days I cannot use the third person he, can barely indulge the you of the wish-fulfilling witness. I've fallen in with the spirit of the I that lost credibility, an indeterminate I soon to become a who, as in who died. I've tried to be a narrator. Okay, I'm also the mysterious traveler waking beside a mountain or sitting by a river back to a city fed by busyness and fear, not feeling like myself. How soiled and tattered the shred ends of the published counselors, their papered slogans, "Never mind you live, never mind you are." There's always a honeyed sun, if not shining, at least to remember. There's always a body, a memory. Words may be trite or stained by commerce, but also consoling. My text has brought me together with my longing. I've been promised on the edge of the indefinable, an apparitional beauty, and they're shining to surround me like amber around a fly. Oh, this aura, oh, companion to the days ahead, days filled with a biblical sweetness, a rebuke to those who hoped for an alternative paradise. Plunge into the book. I'm very interested in what people are calling ekphrastic poetry. So I'll read probably the very first one I wrote very early. This is from the 60s. It's called, "Okay, Everybody, Let's Do the Mondrian Stomp." Small red block beside a long white block, tall white block beside a large white block, yellow block under the tall white block, then a small white block and a long white block and a blue block locked in a corner. And I'll fast forward ahead. I'm going to read this poem since we talked about Mircha. I'll just read this one. It's called Outside a Classroom in Mircha. And has a, my Spanish is so bad now, I'll just say it in English. Yesterday, 5 fishermen died. This is from the 70s, I guess. Gray clouds massed over waves and horizons. Light bands itself to peaks and to the sea, an enormous tarnished plate their boats must plow. Existence, a constant birth of signs, rising toward this, their outward life, febrile, thinner than air, idea, no more than a glimmer, unless a word slams home its bolt. In the narrow streets, walls painted with flaking lime, where at night children sit in front of firepots and see in the maze of lines clowns or dancing bears, faces carried to bed with delicious frights, the ever-readable randomness. In the morning, to stand beside the school, peer through the window glass, no inklings of the lessons, only to watch the teacher talk, the teacher who has the eyes of her poor dumb fisherman father, eyes which look at the children as he looked daily at the sea, the same small anticipations and terrors. Perhaps her words catch the waves' dead glint, but explain indifference to a recalcitrant child. And now the small gyrations of her hands as she tells something to the children, whatever is being said, are as beautiful as the wind-shaped clouds above the mountains. Spooling ahead in time. I've got the page wrong, so I'm going to miss that one. Autobiographia. By the way, my grandfather and great-grandfather were rabbis, so I've got a lot of Jewish thematics through here. This is a little bit of it. Autobiographia. Weren't you given a text to honor the congregation, the organ dulcet, the cantor's hum, hymnal of Europe's east, steps of sound made fugal, but ladened with a weariness, joy for another day, history transmogrified into plaint upon plaint, to be ushered into manhood, to be brought others' pains. Early on, the Shekinah gone into exile, most of that century you saw not love, but power, cruelty, the face which laughs against the sun. What could you do if you were not steeped in things like the others, but merely walk to buy milk or bread, heaven above, earth below, to visit the old streets, the elms' grainy seeds lying across paving stones, tourists milling, and the Atlantic past the bridge, brilliant as a sword cut. Saline, salute, salve, this art burning to base metal, who carries one who would sing a hymn but eddies of language, never the pure thing, maelstroms and tidal pools, word forms, the will hemmed in like an ocean to its basin, rhymed to the rack of its tides, the words ring, deflected in the baffles of the city into space, echo bounced from storefront to tower, fading toward soundlessness, ear cupped to catch emptiness, translation to paradise from which speech fled. Put down this cloth, said the rabbi, cover the text and emplace the cap. Live neither in blacks nor whites, avert from the scroll, rising above the earth, gaze upon limitless blue, the invented weaving of clouds. Live straight ahead, appearance will be your pain and mentor, be at the threshold, not at the ark. And later to go back to plucking a word from the weave, lame, silver, deep magenta, designs mazed over the fold, lines and margins, and underneath as though one sensed through flesh the delicate structure of Beths and Vovs on parchment, the inner and outer of secrets. On a phrase of Milosh's, Milosh, we all know, and the phrase is, he is not disinherited, for he has not found a home. He has found vertiginous life again, the words on the way to language, dangling possibility, but also like the sound of a riff on a riff. It cannot be resolved. History has mucked this up. He has no textbook and must overcompensate, digging into the memory bank, if not for the tune, then for something vibratory on the lower end of the harmonics. He's bound to be off by at least a half note. Here comes jargon, baby, something like a diss or a hiss. Being is incomplete. Only the angels know how to fly homeward. Yet once the desperate situation is clarified, he feels a kind of happiness. Later, the words were displaced and caught fire, burning syllables to enunciate the dead mother's name, Martha, sounding then like mother. Wasn't it such echoes that built the city in which he lives, the cage he paces now like Rilke's panther? He was not disinherited. He was not displaced. He is sentimental. Hence he can say a phrase like his heart burst. The worst thing is to feel only irony can save. The worst thing is to feel only irony. This is a poem for Carl Rakosi, Bandelette de Torah. In the temple service, when the Torah is not being read, they put a cloth over it to protect it. And they're very beautiful, usually, very very wonderful designs. So this is for Carl, and it has a quote from the caption on the museum. "In honor of the Eternal One, it has been made this band and cloak by the young and dignified girl Simcha, daughter of the cantor Joseph Hay, son of the wise and noble Isaac." And I saw this in the Musée d'Art d'Histoire de Judaism in Paris. Bandelette de Toro. "The hunger is for the word between us, between outside and in, between Europe and America, between the Jew and his other, the word and the non-word. In the museum case, belief has been sealed behind glass, the gold yod fist-shaped with extended finger marks where the letter is made free, davar twining aleph into thing. The hunger was once for textured cloth, brocade of thread, gold weld, damask tasselet fringe, for sewn in weight of lead or brass, the chanter lifting all heaviness from the page, singing out lost richness. He followed the gold yod of divining alchemic word in toning the throne's measure in discarded lexicons of cubits and myriads. The cloth lay over Europe's open scroll between Athens and Jerusalem, between library and dream. What if Athens were to be entered only via the syllogism, or Jerusalem's sky were written over in fiery labyrinth, in severe figures, unerring texts? The hunger was for the lost world that lay between Jerusalem and Athens. Later terrors came to be its portion, flames beyond remonstrance, synagogue and worshiper in ash, Salon in the Seine with its syllabary. The words were as burls in woven cloth. They lie across the lettered scroll, ink on paper enveloped in darkness. Desperate to be enmixed with matter, the words were between us, poised to rise into constellator's night as task unto the city, to enter this place unshielded between the one and nothingness, if only to exist as from an echo between hope and horror, between sacred sound and profane air, between Athens and Jerusalem and America." We spend our summers in the Colorado Mountains and the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, beautiful mountains. But on the other side, right across from us, are the famous sand dunes, 100 square miles of sand dunes created by this creek over millions of years. And so this poem uses some of the imagery of that place. It's called Stanzas Without Ozymandias. I guess this is for the English professors in the room, since when I first encountered Ozymandias, it was taught to me as, you know, this is an example of irony, you know. So, Stanzas Without Ozymandias. "Who finds the pedestal finds the poem. To know time had its ruins, its knowledge, the traveler was fortunate. And now sand has its texts, its mica and feldspar, its fulgurites and beaded quartz. The heart a display case, the eye a catchment. Granules adhere to fire-drawn surfaces, mineraled and glassine, acolytes of the grain fused to a speech of unwarrantable sermons. Wind and lightning storms roll the high dunes into long trenches, into tides of erasures now smoothed to a nothingness, an abyss for the geometer who mourned the mirror's lack, who hungered for stars hidden in the dark behind the day's brightness. Hard to remember what tribes wandered with Moses, or even who invoked that seer alchemy when Jesus disappeared for the numbered days of an older flood. Or what tempted the saints to sit in their aloneness at the ledge. Unawares the bush burned and the mirage shimmered. Solitude of those who entered who sought earthly want, though they wandered in the skull of an angel, in the trepanned and bleached spaces, remembering only the colorless semblances of their desires. So now to place a word on it, like a bit of mica winking in the sun, and now to place time on it, as though time were the handwriting of the object's moment, effacement in the grammar, impelling one to be only a shadow. And I'll read from this poem, I'll read Eschaton, which Don mentioned. It was the title poem of the book that it came from. Eschaton. I don't know where spirit is, outside or in, do I see it or not? Time turned the elegies to wickerwork and ripped up phone books, all that worded air unable to support so much as a feather. If there's hope for a visitation, only the ghosts of non-belonging will attend. And now death is slipping back into the category of surprise. I sit up at night and pant, fear, half-rhyming prayer, self beshrouding itself against formlessness. In-breath, out-breath, aria of the ribcage equaling apse, skull, the old relic box. I'm going to read, I did a book, which is here, a kind of a meditation in prose and poetry on the paintings of Max Beckmann. You may know his work. The poems were reprinted in this book, but the prose, which is a kind of an important part of it for me, was not. So anyway, I'll read a couple of the poems from that series, and this is called "Into the Heart of the Real," and it's based on one of Beckmann's paintings called "Removal of the Sphinxes." In German, my German is terrible, so it was. Is that mine?
It's next door.
It is mine. It's an 800 number missed call. I'm sorry I even let that happen. I'm going to shut this down. I hate that.
Max Beckmann Jewish?
No, he wasn't.
No.
No. But there's some very interesting stuff that's been coming out about him, and I happened to meet the editor of his writings, and she's been feeding me information. So I wrote this book, but I have yet, inshallah, I have yet another, you know, something planned on him, because he was involved. His patrons were many of the Nazis, you know, rich manufacturers and so on. So he had a very complex thing. But this poem, which is based on a park that he fled. He fled Germany the night of the night before the opening of the degenerate art exhibit, you know, that the Nazis had created. It turned out to be the most visited exhibit in the history of modern Germany. So they kind of did it wrong, you might say. But he had a number of paintings in there. The night before the exhibition, Hitler made a speech about how important it was to see this art and, you know, hate it and so on. And the very next morning, he left Germany, and he went to live in Amsterdam. Of course, Amsterdam was later occupied by the Nazis. And this poem is based on the gates of a public park that had been donated by a Jewish businessman named Wertheim. It was called originally Wertheim Park, but when the Nazis took over and they had a Nazi mayor, they took the name off, and they covered up these gates, which had these sphinxes on it. And Beckmann painted this picture. And in the title, the German, which is Abtransport der Sphinx, Abtransport was also the word used for transporting Jews to the camps. So he was very pointed about that. Anyway, this is the poem. It's a prose in prose. The Sphinxes have beautifully outlined breasts, and they stand proudly on their taloned feet. And their taloned feet rest proudly on stone pedestals. Wood for crates is stacked nearby, and a sister bird has taken flight. Each sphinx from its platform tells a seductive tale. Each one makes a lyre out of one of the others. Whether on pediments of stone or placed for shipment on the tumbrils, they insist on whispering silky words in one's ear. Little breezes are stirred by their sibilant words, little swirls that are worse than typhoons or tornadoes. Big storms, hurricanes, are the excellence of the world's turning, of massive pressure gradients at the poles, knocking down buildings and flooding streets. But the tiny voices of the sphinxes enter through the ears like silkworms. Each weaves a gummy dream to the bones of the skull, as though it were shadow on the wall of Plato's cave. Each tiny voice blends in with the sound of the real, urgent, unappeasable. There's an official monitoring each skull who, even as he listens, is already insisting on the dream's removal. The sphinxes must be carted off. One thinks that the officials would organize deliveries of this nature in secret, or at least elsewhere. But no, I have seen each one at the embarkation point, eagerly straining on a rope, gleaming with sweat, pulling the crates toward the outgoing barges. I'm just going to read two more poems. I began a series, which is still in progress, call it Faux Translations, of the poetry of Victor Segelin. You may have seen, may know some of his thing. His most famous book is, most well-known book in America, is Stele, which are inscriptions on the Chinese stelae. He lived in China, and he lived in Polynesia. He was the first person to write about the exotic and otherness, and he's had a revival of his work in France. He lived in the early part of the 20th century. He had a little association with the surrealists and so on. but I thought I would read one of his odes from a book that the book that I've been using as a text, which is his Odes to Tibet, in which he kind of invents a language that never existed. He does this in the Stelae. So I took the liberty of kind of doing a pony-type translation and then using some of my own language, mixing it in with his. And this is one of the odes from that, and I'll read that. This is called Kingdom's Winds, and I'm very interested in Buddhist material, and he was very interested in that as well. Kingdom's Winds. This profound air, graveled with age, wind of kingdoms rising over the stale odor of the past, over departed moments, filled now with unimpeded echoes, distant, brined with memory of the sea's ages, yet barbarous and hoarse as an assailing reflux. You are gritted with its powder of sand and brick, but you do not arrive from malevolent plains. You do not mark your descent by those geographic plateaus, nor from elsewhere, lost days rimmed on the abyss of time. You do not carry that burdened water, nor have you quenched the people of the wastelands. You take yourself unslackened, ignorant of polar tundras, of savannas, of gilded meridians that surmount the intangible absence of weathers, characterless over any landscape. Imagine, still you are rich and sultry with non-being, intact and fresh as though time were again descended, suffused with old wisdoms. And despite my self-disgust and my lethargy, you come, a handful of air, to resuscitate with the vastness of your caress. And I'll finish with this poem. I had a book published in England, Selected Poems, and I got the page proofs, and I started looking at this thing, and I looked at the title page and turned it over. This is what I saw. This poem is called Right After the Title Page. This is a sort of in prose as well. The copyright page of my new book from the UK states, quote, "The right of Michael Heller to be identified as the author of this work has been asserted by him." I'm afraid these words are not exactly true. Not only did I not assert anything, neither the name Michael Heller nor the words right and identified, but other words such as work or author scare me. And that phrase, to be, is quite problematic. Such language leaves me a bit sick. In fact, I've had to raise my eyes from the page to remember that the room, the ceiling, the sky are the only arenas of longing, and that meanwhile, I'm still looking where to go, what hallway to wander down, still haven't entered into real concourse with a word since I was a babe and shouted, Mama, Mama. I know a name certainly makes one think he exists, but sorry, I'm not going to look in the mirror to see who I am. Such appearances are not worth bupkis, my mother used to insist, when I grabbed some toy and said, mine or Mike's. I didn't write those words above, didn't even proof them on a page. Perhaps I was meant to declaim them to a crowd wherever a crowd might gather. You want to hear them again? Here they are. The right of Michael Heller to be identified as the author of this work has been asserted by him in accordance with Section 77 of the Copyright Designs and Patents Act, 1988. Woo! Isn't that a mouthful? Okay, now I've said it. But don't you believe it? I don't.